Group meeting, Friday, 16th July, 1982. The first question is this. It concerns the evolution of mankind. At a recent talk, you mentioned that man was not the descendant of the apes, but rather his brother. Could you elaborate on this, please? We'll go on. I don't think I said his brother. We are cousins, not brothers. So I thought it would be interesting, perhaps, to make a few notes and give a little account of the evolution of man. Life apparently first started on this planet something like 600 million years ago. And the first fossil sea animals flourished at that time. Then about 200 million years later, there emerged the vertebrates, these creatures with backbones. And the first amphibians who lived both in the water and on the and land, like the crocodiles and so forth, were basically air-breathing fish. And they began to modify fins into primitive legs. The next stage takes place somewhere around 345 million years ago, when the first reptiles, the reptiles were the crocodiles, began colonization of the earth. The reptiles were followed by mammals, and the development of the mammals culminated with the emergence of man. The specific element which brought about this development was increasing power of adaptation to the environment. This had four or five special points about it. One was warm-bloodedness, which enabled the mammals to withstand any conditions of temperature around them, more or less, and flourish and spread over the earth. The next, there was good insulation through hair, fur, and layers of fat. The third was differentiated teeth. Unlike the reptiles, who had just the same sort of rows of teeth, here there was differentiation, different kinds of teeth. You know, we have canines and molars and so forth, which helps us. So differentiated teeth played their part, and mammals, with the mammals, from being, instead of being like the reptiles, egg-bearing, they gave birth to live young, fully developed inside them, you see. The brain underwent some considerable changes, and intelligent behavior, especially noticeable with the primates, the primates were the main subgroup of the mammals. Now, round about 65 million years ago, the first primates came into existence. They were living in trees, with large brains, relatively well-developed eyes, and with stereoscopic vision. This made a very big difference. Sight became more important to them than smell. Therefore, the muzzle became less important, and instead of we being protruding muzzle, with the development of the eyes, the brain, the back part of the brain where sight makes its impressions, became more and more important. And these primates diversified into four main groups. One group is called the prosimians, the next is the monkeys, the next is the apes, and the last is man. The prosimians were probably tree-dwelling primates resembling modern prosimians, the Galagos, tarsiers, lorises, lemurs, and the tree shrews. They were man's first ancestors in the direct line, so to say. From these evolved the anthropoid primates, swinging and leaping through trees rather than crawling along branches. About 25 to 30 million years ago, one of the primate groups gave rise to the primitive stock from which the pongids, that is the apes, on the one hand, and the hominids, the humans, on the other hand, developed. They'd split into two different lines, you see, and the lines separated out. So the apes are really our cousins, particularly the gorilla and the chimpanzee today represent the peak point of their development, just as we humans of today represent our development. But it went through many, many stages. So the apes, including the chimpanzee and gorilla, paralleled man's evolution between about 25 million and 7 million years ago. Took all that immense time. The Miocene, this happened especially in the Miocene period, which succeeded the Oligocene. It was in this Miocene period that the earliest hominid remains found in India were found in India of this type, and they called it the Ramapithecus. Dated him at about 10 to 12 million years ago. Man exists as the fourth and final subdivision of the primates. Later on, there arose in Africa, that is after Ramapithecus, Australopithecus, who arose approximately 4 to 5 million years ago in the Pliocene period, which succeeded the Miocene. And then Homo erectus, true men, and they were the first true men. They apparently lived in China from about 2.5 million years ago. And finally, there came Homo sapiens in the Pleistocene era, which is very, very much nearer to our own period. Followed by Homo erectus, was followed by Homo sapiens, You know how I have insulted Homo sapiens many, many times, calling him Homo stultus, considering how he behaves now, followed by the type known as Rhodesia man. 800,000 years ago, Homo erectus arose. Of course, these dates undergo changes with new discoveries. So these are about the these are amongst the most recent figures that I have been able to obtain. And so we can see that the apes, the pongid development culminating in the chimpanzee and the gorilla, is a parallel development with the hominid group, and they are literally our cousins. You see? It's a fascinating study, actually. Now, there's a second question here. Every day, terrible and tragic acts are being carried out by our fellow human beings, which arouse the victims and the onlookers to rage, hate, and despair. Should we not regard the perpetrators of these acts as instruments of the Supreme Being, as victims themselves of their circumstances, and deserving our compassion and forgiveness? That's a very good question indeed. I think it might be useful to slightly reword the question. Instead of saying, should we not regard the perpetrators of those acts as instruments of the Supreme Being, and instead of that, if we call them deviators from the true purpose of the existence of human beings, they are deviators. Because after all, most of these terrible things are carried out deliberately. They are not done merely because of their circumstance. Their circumstance has helped them. There are always these, at least these two influences. One is the influence of the environment. If the environment is bad, and the person happens to meet with nothing but the misfortune of all those influences which make a devil of him, you see, well then, he can't be blamed for it. He has to be understood for it. But at the same time, there is this other influence. Our heredity is not an evil heredity. Our heredity is an influence which tends towards development, growth, and fulfilling the purpose of our existence. And this, of course, scientists find very, very difficult to accept. Some are beginning to accept it, but it is difficult for them to accept because they approach the whole question from the material standpoint, the chemistry and physics of the situation and so forth, so that they miss this other element, which is the transcendent aspect. Scientists can deal only with those energies which they can utilize in the laboratory, in their experimental work, which is all material and from the standpoint of matter. They approach it from the standpoint of matter. They do not accept at all that there is another standpoint at least, maybe there may be two or three other standpoints for all we know. Now the fact is that I say it's a fact because to me it is a fact that there is this transcendent element at play. This primordial creative energy is energy of a nature which is quite outside the scope as yet of scientific research. They don't know that sort of energy. You see, they don't quite get the idea that whilst energy as we know it in this world forms one octave of the whole energy scale of, you see, there are other octaves. If you talk like that to the very conventional hardliner scientist, he will shrug his shoulders and say, oh, it's a pleasant idea, but it's very unscientific. Well, of course, it's very unscientific if you arbitrarily confine science to just this realm. Now, there is this transcendent energy at play also. Only it plays in a manner quite different from the way in which energy which we know functions. The energies we know are electricity and magnetism, heat, light, gravitation, chemical energy, mechanical energy, and so on. You see, that is all we know, and nuclear energy. That is what we know, the different forms of energy. But the idea that there may be a kind of energy which is quite different from all this has not yet entered the scientific field at all. Although there are scientists who are accepting the idea of a soul, but they are taking the idea of a non-material spiritual soul in the conventional way, which I think is an inadequate way. For this reason, they are saying now in some of the scientific journals, I mean some of the foremost men in these lines, Karl Popper is against it, but Sir John Eccles and Sir Charles Sherrington and people like that, people like them, they sort of accept the idea of a non-material spiritual soul within man. But you see, they are therefore treating this non-material spiritual energy, let's call it an energy, as something which is an identifiable entity. It's a particular entity within each individual. This is where they make their mistake. On this at this transcendent level, everything functions in wholeness and totality. It's never entered their heads. I mean, even David Bohm, he's gone very, very far with what he has said in his book, Wholeness and the Implicate Order. And he has sort of gently suggested this idea of different octaves of energy existing, you see, as such. But he still, none of them seem to have understood that this functions as a totality all the time. The whole of infinity, the whole of eternity, the whole of this transcendent energy, God in his totality, so to say, functions through each and every particular throughout the universe. Now this is something which is a little bit too radical maybe, I don't know. The suggestion of it exists in Zen in a interesting form. When they talk of the interdiffusion of the totality, the infinity and the particular. The complete interdiffusion. They say that it is all reflected and embodied in the particular. But then we have from very ancient times, especially in the teachings which came from Egypt and and the Fertile Crescent region in the old days, that that man is a microcosm, and he is the reflection of the macrocosm. But then you see, there we had them thinking in terms of a little and a big, and a portion of the big is in the little. That's how we get phrases like a spark of the divine is within each man. No, it's not a spark. The entire flame of the divine is in each and every single living thing, in each and every single atom. This is something which is very difficult to get at. I don't know how it came to me, but it just came in a flash. It was about 1979, I think, when in the autumn, when it first came, that you can't split up into separate little bits that which is the infinite, the transcendent, the eternal, the immortal. You can't split them up and then say, oh, this is my little bit of infinity and eternity. You can't. How can you have a little bit of infinity? It has become finite by making it a little bit. This is the point. I can't understand why ordinary logical intellect couldn't enable people to see this. And I think what helped me really to see it finally was what modern science has been discovering. This interconnectedness of all phenomena, especially in the subatomic world. You see? Everything is completely interconnected. You can't separate out any one thing. And science itself has stated that if we want to know all about any particular thing, any particular little phenomenon, we would have to know all about every other single phenomenon. The interconnection is so complete and so great. The interfluence, as I've called it in the Heart of Religion, it comes in that section which deals with, in the last chapter, the merging. That section called the merging. So, let us come back to this question then here. The perpetrators of these acts. Now, we as human beings have this power of choice in us. Even the most terrible person in the world has that in him which could thrill to something marvelous. And sort of see something different. One can't call them instruments. I wouldn't call them instruments of the Supreme Being, but I would certainly agree that they are victims of their circumstance. Their circumstance has so imprisoned the transcendent in them, has so blinded them to it, so desensitized them that they cannot possibly thrill in response to it, that they do such things. And as such, therefore, of course, they deserve our compassion. And forgiveness, I don't know. Forgiveness is a strange word. Who am I to forgive anybody? You notice, this element of forgiveness comes most strongly in the New Testament. Jesus never says, I forgive you.
No, it's in the Lord's Prayer. Huh? Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive them that trespass against us.
Yes, that's in the Lord's Prayer. Yes, yes, true enough. It is put in that form for the sake of ordinary mortals, you see.
It is the our and them, not the I and the you.
Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive them.
So it's our trespasses and them. There's no No singular there, is there, for us?
Yes, if you take it in the total sense,
total,
all right.
Ours and theirs,
yes.
Not I and
yes.
Mine.
But
the point is, sorry, may I say,
yes, go.
The point is that thy sins be forgiven.
Yes, he says, thy sins be forgiven. And you see, he says, thy sins be forgiven, with the implication that it is God alone who forgives, God the Father who can forgive. He has the power of forgiveness. Jesus disclaims for himself the power to forgive. What does forgiveness imply in the first instance?
That you have made a judgment.
Huh?
That you have judged something. Don't you not make a judgment?
Not to make a judgment. Forgiveness really implies to be free from one's personal individual judgment. You forego. There is a foregoing. And because oneself foregoes, therefore the totality forgives. I know it's easy to say that this is just a play on words. But think it carefully. It comes in the chapter on karma in Ethic and Transcendental Ethic. It comes in that chapter in early Indian religious thought.
But yes, to be in that position, to have that feeling, you must be hurt before, because what are you forgiving?
Exactly.
So you must have been hurt. Which is an ego there.
Yes,
to
yes.
Hurt.
Yes.
It looks like an ego thing to forgive.
This is why.
What thing?
Sorry?
What looks like an ego. E-G-O.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
An ego.
Sorry
for my ego. But ask
another. This is why.
Like that.
This is why, if one can be totally observant. Totally observant, which implies that there is no reaction from one's conditioned brain towards that which one is observing. Then, in that pure observation, there is no room for forgiving or any such thing.
Surely that is the forgiveness, isn't it, for us?
It brings about the condition of forgiveness for the person who is doing the wrong, but you see, in the ordinary way, when one says,
yes, like
our deserving our compassion and forgiveness, you see, it becomes so complete, so absolute, that there is no element, there is no question of deserving or anything like that involved in it. This is how it happens. That is all. No, but I mean, I am only trying to sort of see it in another light. There is another very, very interesting question here. What form of religious education is helpful to open up children to the religious life? Well, this reminds me of the Lohitya Sutta. A Brahman called Lohitya approaches the Buddha and inquires, who is the blameless teacher? And if you study that discourse carefully, you will find that the blameless teacher is none other than the perfected Holy One himself. He alone is the truly blameless teacher. Now, in the same way, we might just as well inquire, who are the blameless parents. Because if parents are blameless, then they being living exemplars of the religious life would influence their children in the right direction as far as religion is concerned. But in ordinary everyday in the everyday world, such parents are, shall we put it mildly, slightly difficult to find. None of us are perfect, and so on. But I think there are certain things we can consider. Instead of trying to produce a system of education for the children which will open them up to the religious life as such, if parents themselves live the religious life as perfectly as is possible for them to live, then that will be a constant influence upon the children. Children are very, very sensitive in an unconscious sort of way. They are really affected by what their parents are and how their parents live. They are very, very sensitive to that, you see. Then, as the child grows up, the child naturally starts asking questions. First and foremost, where did I come from? And of course, mummy says, you were in my tummy first. And that's the starting point. And not very long after that, the child begins to question, I was in my mummy's tummy. Sounds a bit phony to me. And then it wants a little more accurate detail and so forth. Well, one can give the accurate detail, and in giving the accurate detail, give it in a way which evokes the sense of wonder and the marvel, the beauty of the whole thing, really. Although there is pain involved for the mother in giving birth and in the bearing too, very often, you see. But if this sense of wonder and beauty can be evoked, and the sense that this is something, the sense of sacredness, of sanctity, can be associated with the emergence of a living being. Once that is there, once that feeling has stirred a little bit, it is not too difficult to relate that feeling to something which is greater than oneself. First and foremost, it will be a case of the unity of the family, that the child or the pair or either parent is not a separate individual, that we are one, that sense of unity and oneness, and therefore trust and right relationship in terms of consideration, kindliness, benevolence, and all the what we call the spiritual and moral values, they can all be introduced. And as the intellectual side of the child begins to grow, then one can help the child to understand for himself, without telling him that this is so, that this, without being dogmatic about it. Let the child think, and constantly tell the child, what do you feel about it? What do you think about it? And be very careful how, step by step, what is possible for the child to digest is given. to the child. Don't give something which the child is beyond the child's intelligence, because then the tendency is to cast it. I can't understand this. This is something else. Let me go and play cricket. You see. But if this sort of thing is, and the child is drawn out, which is the real meaning of to educate, means to draw out of the child, you see, its potential, its natural potentialities, then I think the sense, the religious sense as such, will begin to come to fructification ultimately. It seems to me something like that would be about the best way to deal with the children. Now, I know from Sylvia's and my own experience with John and Robert, there was no sort of particular religious education given to them. And when they first had sort of religious instruction classes at school and so forth, it meant nothing to them. They were a little bit poo-poo-y about it, quite naturally so, you see. Because what is given as religious education, instruction, is just so many ideas, so many myths, and they are presented as literal facts, which of course any intelligent child will reject naturally, you see. So they grew up free to inquire all the time, and after they had grown up and they were in their late 20s, I noticed that they were really religious in the deep inner sense. They have this sense of considerateness, not just for their particular friends or their own family, but considerateness as a general virtue of kindliness, of relationship, of being free of this this very isolative consciousness. I am so and so, and the others are others. There is a unification. The universe is a universe in their consciousness, and so forth. So, although they don't subscribe to any particular religion as such, I think they are definitely religious, both of them, in their nature. It's a very difficult problem altogether, how to bring children up. You see, the thing is, we shouldn't try to open them up. We should help them to open for themselves, like a bud opens. I have time and again watched an iris opening out. And it's simply wonderful, you know, it's like that, there's this little quiver and suddenly it does that. And it goes on a little while and there's another little quiver and suddenly it's like that. And another little while later, there it is, the full flower. Its inner life has been helped out. And it seems to me that in that sort of way, we have the best means of opening up a child to religiousness.